Again, hello there all. This is Mitchell Warren from AVAC, and delighted to welcome you to the latest in our webinar series running all year on research and reality. And this mini series that has been running since early September as follow-up to some of the key pieces of information that were presented at the AIDS 2014 conference in Melbourne. Today we actually have a threefer, so to speak. For those of you who've been on past calls the last few weeks, we've had individual presentations on key issues. Today's call includes three wonderful presentations that you're about to see and hear. There's a lot to absorb, and I'm sure many questions that will come. So we have a lot of ground to cover, and we'll try to do it as quickly as we can in the three presentations and then open it up for questions and comments. Throughout the call, if you do have any questions as we go, feel free to email avac@avac.org, or on the ReadyTalk feature, you can put in questions in the chat box, and we'll be keeping track of those, and I'll be asking those as we go after the three presentations. In addition, at the end of the call, everyone should be in a muted mode to keep the line clear for recording. You'll be able to, I'll give you the instruction for how to dial the numbers to unmute yourself, introduce, and ask questions, and then and hopefully we can have a good discussion across all three presentations. And for those who either have to drop off early or want to share this with others who aren't able to join, this call, along with all the others, will be available on the website shortly after the call, so people can follow up and hear and learn more. As I say, this today's call does include three different presentations. They were presented in a really exciting session at the conference in Melbourne. There were other presentations in that session, but we wanted to highlight these three to give a sense of where we are with our knowledge and our questions related to hormonal contraceptives and HIV. The lineup for today in the three presentations is going to take us from a specific level to a very large global level. We're going to start with a presentation with data from a particular country and a particular population. We'll then have a presentation on a very large meta-analysis, which you will hear about, both how it's done and what its results are. And then we'll have a global perspective from the World Health Organization. So it's, I think, a really exciting lineup. And again, I want to just thank all three presenters for taking the time to adapt their slides and for being part of today's discussion. We're going to start, as I say, with a very specific view from Zambia. And I'm delighted to welcome Kristen Wall from Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia, who works with the Rwandan Zambia HIV Research Group, who've been working for decades now in both countries with a particular focus on serodiscordant couples and engaging serodiscordant couples in a range of different studies. And Kristen's going to walk us through what has been now almost two decades of work and looking at evidence from there. So without further ado, I'll turn it over to you, Kristen.
Okay, great. Can you hear me okay?
I can indeed. Thank you.
Okay, wonderful. Hello, everyone. I just want to first thank you all so much for joining this discussion today. Again, my name is Kristen Wall, and I'm presenting this data on behalf of the Rwanda-Zambia HIV Research Group, which is based at Emory University. And I want to first extend a big thanks to the AVAC webinar series for organizing this event, which I'm sure is going to be a very, very interesting presentation and interesting discussions. So the objective of the study that I'll be discussing is really captured in the title of my talk, and that objective was to determine the impact of hormonal contraception on the risk of HIV acquisition among Zambian women who were in HIV serodiscordant couples. So I'd first like to state that neither I nor our co-authors have any conflicts of interest. So by way of brief background, as most people know, hormonal contraception, including DMPA injectables, oral contraceptive pills, or OCPs, and the contraceptive implant, prevent unintended pregnancy and therefore prevent vertical HIV transmission, which is prong two of prevention of mother-to-child transmission, or PMTCT. And hormonal contraceptive methods are widely used in areas that can currently have a very high HIV prevalence. This overlap occurs predominantly in Southern African and Western African countries. So, for example, in Zambia, where we're working, the countrywide HIV prevalence is about 14%. And it was estimated by the Demographic and Health Surveys that about 11% of married women are using OCPs, 9% are using injectables, predominantly DMPA, and less than 1% use the contraceptive implant. So the effect of hormonal contraception on HIV acquisition among women is obviously a very debated issue, and the existing evidence on this issue, which comes primarily from observational cohort studies like the one I'm going to present today, is conflicting. The previous studies have also suffered from various design and analytical challenges, which have made these conflicting findings quite difficult for policymakers and researchers to interpret and to synthesize. So these challenges were thoroughly discussed for several peer-reviewed published studies in a recent systematic review that was published just last month, I believe, in Contraception by Chelsea Polis, and also a series of recommendations to improve study design and analytical methods were developed and published again by Polis and AIDS just last year. These are two wonderful publications, and I do want to note that in the study I'm going to discuss today, we were very cognizant of the recommendations made in this latter publication, and our design and analysis methods really allowed for more comprehensive consideration of many of the challenges mentioned in these articles. So our study population consists of HIV serodiscordant couples who were identified from couples voluntary HIV counseling and testing services, which were offered by the Rwanda Zambia HIV Research Group in Lusaka. Lusaka is the capital of Zambia. And we were enrolling and following couples from 1994 until 2012. The analysis I'm going to present today is restricted to couples in which the man was HIV positive and the woman was HIV negative at enrollment. And we only analyzed data from couples who had at least one follow-up visit and couples in which the HIV positive male partner was not on antiretroviral treatment or ART. Our couples were followed longitudinally at 3-month intervals, during which contraceptive methods were provided to women at the research site, and the HIV negative women were retested at the research site. So our exposure of interest is is contraceptive method that is used either at baseline or at these 3-monthly follow-up visits, and therefore it's a time-varying measure. And we categorize these methods as being either hormonal methods, so this is the implant, DMPA injectable, or oral contraceptive pills or OCPs, versus a non-hormonal control, which includes women using condoms, the copper IUD, or permanent methods like hysterectomy, tubal ligation, or women whose partners have had this disease. So our analysis considers two primary outcomes of interest among the women partners. The first is any incident HIV infection, whether genetically linked or unlinked to the study partner. And the second is incident HIV infections that were genetically linked to the study partner. We used multivariate Cox models to estimate the effect of these time-varying contraceptive methods on the risk of HIV acquisition. We considered the potential for effect measure modification by genital ulceration, genital inflammation, the viral load of the HIV-positive male partner at baseline, the couple's baseline fertility and woman's age. And we also conducted extensive sensitivity analyses, and I've mentioned some here. We looked at what would the effect be if we used slightly different ways to categorize our exposure and our control groups. We looked at the potential influence of misclassification of unprotected sex. And then we looked at, we used marginal structural models to explore the potential biases that can occur when time-varying confounders are simultaneously acting as mediators. So among the almost 1,400 couples that we followed, 252 incident infections occurred in women over 3,000 couple years, or CY. So this gives you an incidence rate of about 8.9 per 100 couple years overall for the cohort. And then when stratifying by the contraceptive method, we see that the seroconversion rates for OCP users and injectable users are slightly increased over women who are using non-hormonal methods in this univariate analysis. However, in a multivariate Cox model, and this is showing the results of the model for time to any HIV infection, so again, genetically linked or unlinked to the study partner, these multivariate models indicated that neither injectable, oral contraceptive pill, or implant use was significantly associated with HIV acquisition relative to non-hormonal control. And this model was controlling for women's age, literacy, time-varying measures of sperm being present on a vaginal swab wet prep, and time-varying measures of genital ulceration and inflammation in the women partners. And our findings remained essentially the same when additionally controlling for fertility intentions and or pregnancy. So this slide is just recapping the results of our second multivariate model that was looking at linked infections only. And this model controlled for the confounders previously mentioned, as well as couples self-reported unprotected sex in the past 3 months, time-varying measures of genital ulceration and inflammation of the male partner, and the man's viral load at baseline. And similarly, the results of our sensitivity analyses also did not indicate any increased risk for hormonal contraceptive method users. So finally, we wanted to begin to explore, you know, why did we see these crude rates of seroconversion that were higher for women using OCPs and injectables? And, you know, we thought maybe this could begin to shed some light on why some studies have seen this increased risk and others have not. So we wanted to look at the association between several measures of unprotected sex, which is likely one of the largest confounding factors in most studies, and contraceptive method use. And what we found was that compared to non-hormonal method users, OCP users experienced significantly more incident pregnancies, self-reported more unprotected sex, and had sperm on a wet prep more often. And we also found that injectable users self-reported more unprotected sex and had sperm on a wet prep more often than non-hormonal method users. And finally, and conversely, we found that implant users experienced significantly fewer incident pregnancies, self-reported less unprotected sex, and had sperm on a wet prep less often than non-hormonal method users. So these findings indicate that the crude increases in the seroconversion rates that were experienced by women using OCPs and injectables could potentially be explained, at least in part, by these differences in unprotected sex. So as I mentioned at the start of my talk, we were very cognizant of several common design and analytical challenges, and I wanted to list some of the sort of strengths of our study here. So first of all, we enrolled and followed a discordant couple cohort, which allowed us to be more confident about couples having a uniform exposure to HIV across the various methods. And of course, using a discordant couple cohort versus a sample, for example, drawn from the general population increases study efficiency. And I also want to mention that given what we know about the epidemiology of HIV in Africa, we feel it is unethical in most cases to test and follow HIV-negative women or men from the general population without testing their cohabiting partners. Additionally, we provided the method of contraception at the research site, which improves the accuracy of exposure assessment. And we also provided or assessed these methods at 3 monthly intervals in order to try to capture method stopping and switching, which we know are occurring at relatively high rates in our cohort. And finally, and quite importantly, we captured several measures of unprotected sex, including, as I mentioned, sperm on a wet prep, self-reported frequency of protected and unprotected sex, self-reported number of sex partners, incident STIs, and, of course, incident pregnancy. And so I'd like to reemphasize here that these are the types of design issues that are very important to consider when weighing the strength of evidence from an individual study. And I'm sure, you know, Dr. Morrison will mention this more in the context of assessing the quality of individual studies used in meta-analyses, for example. So in conclusion, we found no association between hormonal contraceptive methods and HIV acquisition risk in Zambian women in HIV discordant couples. And this is after a thorough consideration of confounding effect measure modification and extensive sensitivity analyses. And we feel that these findings obviously add to a very controversial literature and will be important when considering future changes to guidance on hormonal contraceptive method use among women at high risk of HIV. And so we recommend that condom counseling is needed for all women at risk of HIV, and the results of our study indicate that reinforced condom counseling is needed among women who are using OCPs and injectables because they appear to be having more unprotected sex. And this is a finding that we want to continue to explore. And we also want to emphasize that HIV testing of partners together is critical in order to ascertain the HIV risk of the negative partners or the negative people you're following. And it can also provide the opportunity to determine the couple level fertility intentions. And therefore it will allow providers to be able to counsel couples more appropriately. And pragmatically, this can be achieved by integrating HIV and family planning services with a focus on couples. And finally, we are supportive of increasing the method mix, specifically supportive of LARC promotion or the long-acting method promotion, which are both proven strategies to decrease unintended pregnancy and therefore vertical HIV transmission. So I would like to end by thanking my absolutely wonderful team of collaborators and contributors at the Rwanda Zambia HIV Research Group. As I said, I'm really presenting this data, which is the result of years of hard and meticulous work on behalf of an amazing team of investigators and clinical staff and study participants. And I'd like to acknowledge the invaluable support of the Zambian Ministry of Health and District Health Management team, and to, of course, acknowledge our funders, without whom this study wouldn't have been possible, and to particularly acknowledge the support of the International AIDS Vaccine Initiative. Thank you all so much.
Great. Kristen, thank you so very, very much. Questions are coming in, which is terrific. Please keep them coming via email at avac@avac.org as well as in the chat feature. But in the interest of time, we're going to go directly to our next presentation, which is from Charlie Morrison at FHI 360, and Kristen mentioned the meta-analysis. Charlie has worked on this issue for many years and has been on a number of webinars over the last couple of years, but in Melbourne presented a very large data set based on a meta-analysis across a number of trials, which he will describe now. And Charlie, we'll see if we can hear you, and if not, you'll hit star 7.
Yeah, okay, can you hear me?
Yes, perfect.
Okay, good. Good. So thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity to talk this morning or this afternoon for those of you in Africa on describing this large meta-analysis, which includes many studies and many data sets. So the title of the talk that I gave in Melbourne was Hormonal Contraception and the Risk of HIV Acquisition and Individual Participant Data Meta-Analysis. And let's see, can I click to forward these, or do you need
actually,
to do
that? Yeah, here we go. Go ahead.
Okay. So I really want to thank all the study authors. This is really the result of many different studies. You'll see there are actually 18 different studies included. I especially want to thank Pailin Chen at FHI and Nicola Lowe at University of Bern, who've really been highly involved in the conceptualizing and the implementation of this meta-analysis. go ahead. So just by way of background, obviously the benefits of contraception for women and societies are well accepted. Evidence from observational studies on whether hormonal contraception alters a woman's risk of HIV acquisition is mixed, as you've heard. An individual participant data meta-analysis of hormonal contraception and HIV risk can overcome some of the limitation of single studies and meta-analysis of aggregated published data. And I just want to say what's meant by that is combining the effect estimates of many different studies. That's what's meant by meta-analysis of aggregated published data without having the actual individual participant data. So the objectives of the meta-analysis was to determine whether use of different hormonal contraceptives, including combined oral contraceptives, or COCs, Depo-Provera, or DMPA, and Nerisarat, or NEDN, which is the two-monthly injectable, which is primarily used in South Africa, increases the risk of HIV acquisition compared to women not using hormonal contraception. To evaluate whether age and HSV2, herpes simplex 2 infection status, modifies the effect of hormonal contraception on the risk of HIV, and then to directly compare the risk of HIV acquisition among the three hormonal contraceptive groups. So the inclusion criteria for a study to be part of this meta-analysis is the study had to measure hormonal contraception and HIV prospectively at multiple time points using standardized measures, include women between 15 and 49 years of age, had to include women using injectable contraception to detect at least 15 incident HIV infections, to have follow-up visits at most 6 months apart, and virtually all of them had them at either 1 month apart or 3 months apart. I think there was one study that had 6 months apart. Not missing more than 5% hormonal contraceptive or HIV infection data, and then to measure several important covariates, including age, condom use, and number of sex partners. So we used, our primary method was a two-stage random effects model. So in the first stage, you essentially estimate the hazard ratios for hormonal contraception on HIV for each individual study, controlling for a common set of covariates or confounders. In the second stage, we obtain the weighted hazard ratio from all the studies from estimated adjusted HRs using meta-analysis. And again, the primary results were based on random effects model, although we did test a fixed effects model as well. But the random effects model allows for variance in the effect estimates across the studies. We did a number of subgroup and sensitivity analysis. The size of the meta-analysis really allowed us to do this with quite a bit of power. And we used statistical tests of interaction to examine results according to age, to HSV2 antibody status, to the risk of methodological bias of the component studies, to pregnancy status, to person time where women reported no condom use, to HIV incidence in the study populations, and to the region of the study, whether Eastern, Southern, or South Africa. All these studies were from Sub-Saharan Africa. So this shows a flow diagram of included studies. So starting on the top row, we had identified 10 studies from the Vaginal Practices Research Partnership, which was a partnership of studies that had brought data together to consider the issue of vaginal practices in HIV. And then through reviewing systematic reviews and talking with other collaborators, we identified an additional 19 studies. So essentially, we assessed 29 studies for eligibility. We approached the investigators in 21 studies, but did not in 8 studies. In the investigators that we approached, we included 18 of the studies. We were not able to make contact with the investigator of one study, and we did not reach an agreement or receive a data set by the time of our cutoff, which was essentially September 2012 for 2 studies. Among the investigators not approached, All those studies were excluded. Two were not in sub-Saharan Africa, and six others did not meet inclusion criteria. So in the end, we included 18 studies in the IPD meta-analysis. So I thought I'd just show you contraceptive use by region, and just overall in the lower right-hand corner, you can see that there were about 44,000 person years or women years in this study. And this, going over to the left-hand side under all studies, which is bolded on the bottom, this included about 37,000 women. 43% did not use a hormonal method, and this includes women using non-hormonal methods, but it also uses some women who either use no method or use condoms or their partners use condoms inconsistently. About 19% used combined oral contraceptives, 28% DMPA, and about 8% net N. I thought I'd show you a little bit about the contraceptive use patterns. If you look at the top row, you can see that about two-thirds of the women did not switch their method during their time in the study. And in general, we followed women for about 24 months, although in some studies up to 30 months. So about two-thirds never switched their method. There were about, of the women in the non-hormonal group, about a sixth of those started hormonal contraception at some point in time. And then if you look down at the bottom row, you can see that approximately 13 to 15% switch methods multiple times during their study period. So if we go on to sort of the main results of the study, these are the unadjusted hazard ratios for time-varying contraceptive use by region. Again, these are not adjusting for any possible confounders. And if we look at the bottom row at all the studies, you can see that for combined oral contraceptives, the hazard ratio is 1.01. There was no relationship between COCs and HIV risk. Again, in the univariate analysis, for both DMPA with a hazard ratio of 1.56 and for net N with a hazard ratio of 1.51, there was an increased risk of HIV acquisition. Moving on now to the adjusted hazard ratios, and I believe that these all adjusted for region, whether a woman was married or living with a partner, condom use, numbers of recent sexual partners, and I think there's one more. This will be outlined more specifically on another slide. But this shows basically the hazard ratios for all the studies. The line, the sort of gray line that goes from the top to the bottom in the middle is the 1.0 line, which is essentially equality. Studies that have the little hash mark in the middle to the left indicate a decreased risk of HIV. Studies with the little hash line in the middle of the confidence interval to the right suggest an increased risk of HIV. So you can see that most of these studies are skewed towards the right-hand side. And the diamond at the bottom is really the summary of all the studies together. And if you go over to the right-hand side, you can see there was a hazard ratio of 1.50. The confidence intervals exclude one. So this suggests an increased risk of HIV acquisition across all the studies. And then if you go over to the left-hand side in bold at the bottom, you can see the I-squared statistic, which suggests that there was mild to moderate heterogeneity in the results of the studies. So essentially that it was appropriate to combine all these into one risk estimate. Now, if we move on to the next forest plot, this shows the adjusted hazard ratios for COC use. And if you just look across all the different studies, you can see that the hash marks in the middle of the confidence intervals are really tend to be very close to one, either on one side or the other. And at the bottom, you can see the diamond. The overall hazard ratio was 1.03. So there was really no difference in the risk of HIV acquisition among COC users compared to women not using hormonal contraception. And the overall I squared was zero, suggesting very, very low heterogeneity between studies in their effect estimates. And then moving on to net N, the first thing you can see here is that I believe there are only eight studies that had effect estimates for net N. Again, the studies tend to be to a little bit of the right of the 1.0 line. The diamond at the bottom shows you, indicates that the hazard ratio was 1.24. However, the confidence intervals overlap one, so this was not statistically significant. And again, there was low to moderate heterogeneity in the effect estimates across studies. Now, we also did these direct comparisons between the hormonal methods, and so the adjusted HIV hazard ratios for DMPA compared to combined oral contraceptives, the adjusted hazard ratio, and again, this is adjusted for, you can see at the bottom, for age, married, living with partner, number of sex partners, condom use, and region. The adjusted hazard ratio is 1.43. It was statistically significant, suggesting that women using DMPA were at higher HIV risk than women using COCs. And we found similar, although slightly lower results for DMPA versus NetN, suggesting that DMPA users were at increased risk compared to NetN users. And finally, at the bottom, we compared NetN directly with COC users, and we find a kind of a borderline result, an adjusted hazard ratio of 1.30. The lower part of the confidence limit was at 0.99. So this was a little slightly above P equals 0.05, so it's kind of a borderline finding. Now, we carried out a risk of bias assessment, so we had several of the investigators independently rated all of the 18 studies and assessed what we thought was the risk of methodological bias in the studies. And we based this on the follow-up rate, the ability to adjust for an expanded set of covariates, having follow-up visits 3 months or more frequently apart, and having at least 10% of participants in a non-hormonal comparison group. So when we tested at the bottom, you can see in bold, we tested for the risk of bias times the hormonal contraception interaction. We found statistically significant interactions for DMPA and for NetN. And really for all the contraceptive methods, those studies that we felt were at higher risk of methodological bias for assessing the relationship between hormonal contraception and HIV, and that's important. This was for this particular relationship. Many of these included here were randomized clinical trials that really were excellent assessments of, you know, microbicides or other interventions, but this was for assessment of the hormonal contraception HIV relationship. So we saw, looking at the top row, those at higher risk of bias that we judged at higher risk of bias had higher hazard ratios, and those at lower risk of bias had lower hazard ratios. Again, no difference for COCs, as kind of a borderline increased risk for DMPA, and actually a statistically significant lower risk for NetN. So to summarize the other subgroup and sensitivity analysis, we found no evidence of effect modification by either age or HSV2 infection status. In other words, among younger and older women and among women with HSV2 and without HSV2, we didn't see any statistically significant differences in the results. We found no evidence of differences in effect by three different ways of handling pregnancy, either treating pregnancy as a time-varying covariate, censoring women at the visit before they became pregnant, or entirely excluding women who ever became pregnant during the study. We also found no evidence of differences when we limited the time only to those periods when women reported no condom use, which is thought to be more accurate than including all the person time, because there isn't really a good reason for women to over-report condom use in these studies. And also, we did not find any difference in effect by level of incidence, and this was the HIV incidence in the non-hormonal group in each study. We did find some evidence of effect modification by the region of the study. So measures of effect for DMPA and for combined oral contraceptives were higher for studies in East Africa than in Southern or South Africa. Now, the strengths of the meta-analysis include that we used the same analysis method in all the studies, and this can reduce the heterogeneity in the study results due to different analytic approaches. We were able to use subgroup analyses to explore variability at the study level, at the site level, and at the individual participant level across the studies. So we could look at region, we could look at age, we could look at low versus high HIV incidence, for example. And we were able to do some adjustment for imbalances in baseline characteristics between the groups in each study. Some of the limitations include that there are differences in design or and conduct of this in the individual studies which cannot be avoided. For example, some studies followed women every 1 month, other studies followed women every 6 months. We really can't do anything to adjust for these differences. We also had a limited ability to control for selection biases. That would be systematic differences between participants' characteristics in the HC exposure groups. And there can be some residual confounding. Not all subgroups and potential confounding variables were available in all the studies. And so we had to limit it. Our main analysis was based on a common set of the 5 or 6 covariates. So in conclusion, use of DMPA but not COCs or NetN was associated with an increased risk of HIV acquisition in this large individual participant data meta-analysis. The overall results were consistent across many sensitivity analyses. However, we did see that studies at lower risk of methodological bias had lower effect estimates for hormonal contraception than those at higher risk of bias. And that would suggest that some of the differences that we're seeing could be explained by possibly some confounding or some selection biases. A well-conducted randomized clinical trial would provide more definitive evidence of the effects of hormonal contraception on HIV acquisition. And as many of you know, there is a group that has been planning a trial such as this. But this study underscores the need for additional safe and effective contraceptive options for women at high HIV risk, and also for the best possible information that we can get for counseling and helping women in countries to make choices about their contraceptive methods. So thank you.
Charlie, thank you so very much. Always hard in mute for both Kristen and for Charlie to know the response, but I know there are lots of questions and lots of interest, so thank you so very much. And it's actually a great setup for our third presentation, and before we open it up for questions, which I will remind you again, you can always put into the chat feature online or at avac.org. But before we open up the line for questions, I do want to turn to the third presenter, Mary Lynn Gaffield, who's actually at the World Health Organization in the Department of Reproductive Health, and who's an epidemiologist there, who is going to provide an update based, again, on her presentation in Melbourne about the latest recommendations from WHO in this domain. So, Mary Lynn. Oh, Mary Lynn, if you are muted, you need to hit *7. Mary Lynn? Bear with us for just 1 minute. Well, I know someone is off mute. I can hear typing.
Sorry, that's me.
No problem, Charlie. I knew it had to be you or Kristen. I was hoping it was Mary Lynn. I know she's on the web feature. Mary Lynn, if you hit *7, you'll be able to be heard.
There we go.
Oh, hello. Wonderful. Hello there.
Sorry about that.
Not a problem at all.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Very much. Thank you very much. Well, good afternoon, everyone. Good morning. And thank you, Mitchell and colleagues at AVAC, for inviting me to give a little synopsis of the presentation during the session in Melbourne earlier this year. I first want to start with a tremendous thank you to my co-authors, Sharon Phillips, Rachel Bagley, Petra Stein, and Dr. Marlene Timmerman, as well as to thank Kate Curtis, Kavita Nanda, and Chelsea Polis, who helped draft the guidance document that is the focus of today's presentation. So let's see. Mitchell, can there we go. Well, just as a reminder, for nearly 20 years, WHO's Department of Reproductive Health and Research has produced the Medical Eligibility Criteria for Contraceptive Use Guidance, or MEC as we like to call it. The MEC is an evidence-based guidance that provides nearly 1,800 recommendations on the safety of contraceptive use for women and men with certain medical conditions or personal characteristics. In particular, this document includes recommendations on contraceptive eligibility for women at high risk of HIV, women living with HIV, and women taking antiretroviral therapy. During 2013, WHO, as part of its continued effort to keep its evidence-based recommendations up to date, initiated a revision of this document, which we are actually currently in the process of finalizing. However, as we've discussed earlier, as been discussed earlier during this webinar, given the public health importance of the recommendations concerning HIV-related conditions, WHO issued these recommendations in July during the International AIDS Conference in advance of the completion of the entire guidance, which we actually hope to finalize in March or April of 2015. Thank you. So although some of you may already be familiar with the format of the MEC recommendations, I'd like to take a moment to briefly review the meaning of the four-category scale that is used to indicate contraceptive eligibility. Category 1 conditions indicate a medical condition such as living with HIV or a characteristic such as being at high risk of acquiring an HIV infection. A Category 1 means that there are no restrictions on the use of the method. Conditions classified as Category 2 indicate that the method can generally be used, but careful follow-up may be required. Category 3 conditions are those that require careful clinical judgment and access to clinical services. And for methods that are categorized as Category 4 conditions, use of them may present an unacceptable health risk, and the method in question should not be used. In certain situations, separate recommendations will be made if eligibility differs according to whether the woman is initiating or continuing to use the method. And lastly, in settings where resources for clinical judgment are limited, this four-category scale can be simplified into two categories. Thus, for women with a condition classified as either a Category 1 or Category 2 condition, they can use the method. Whereas if the woman has a condition that is classified as a Category 3 or 4, she should not use the method. To continue on to the next slide. So I want to mention that as this revision was initiated in 2013, we embarked on it by following WHO's recommendations for guideline development. So first, a guideline development group was organized and tasked with defining the scope of the revision as well as defining population, intervention, comparator, and outcome, or we call PICO questions, which then guide the preparation and synthesis of the evidence. Four systematic reviews of the published, peer-reviewed epidemiological and available pharmacological evidence pertaining to HIV through January of 2014, this year, were summarized in these reviews. From these reviews, grade evidence profiles were prepared. These profiles provided an assessment of the quality of the evidence for each outcome of interest, and as a part of the process, the group reviewed the summarized evidence from the four systematic reviews and considered the quality of the evidence presented in the grade profiles. And when we developed these recommendations, if needed, the group prepared a clarification to offer further explanation to the numerical classification, which I will show you in just a moment. And all of these decisions were determined through a consensus-based process. So next slide. Let's see. Okay. So to start with, I have abbreviated the presentation from Melbourne, but the evidence that summarized that contributed to the recommendations for women living at high risk of HIV has actually been published in July 2014. It was the lead author was Chelsea Polis, and Kirsten Wall actually presented the citation of this review in her slide presentation. So the evidence that is underpinning these recommendations is now publicly available in open access format. So just to briefly summarize these recommendations, a search of the literature identified 22 studies which assessed the risk of HIV acquisition among women using a method of hormonal contraception compared with women not using hormonal contraception. However, the review of the evidence for this question was restricted to 9 studies which were classified to be considered informative but with important limitations. And it bears noting that each of the 22 studies that the initial search identified suffered from methodological flaws that limit or complicate the interpretation. So these recommendations here are based on the 9 studies in the systematic review. So to briefly summarize, for women at high risk of acquiring HIV sexually, based on the advice of the Guideline Development Group, WHO convened, WHO continues to recommend no restrictions on the use of all hormonal methods of contraception, with the exception and including the levonorgestrel-releasing intrauterine device. But you'll note that for Depo-Provera and for Northestrin Enantate, the group, as in 2012 when the evidence was reviewed, the Guideline Development Group advised WHO that a clarification was warranted. Briefly, the clarification notes that available studies on the association between progestogen-only injectable contraception and HIV acquisition have important methodological limitations that hinder their interpretation. Some studies suggest that women using progestogen-only injectable contraception may be at increased risk of HIV acquisition, while other studies have not found this association. The public health impact of any such association would depend upon the local context, including rates of injectable contraceptive use, maternal mortality, and HIV prevalence. And this must be considered when adapting guidelines to local contexts. WHO expert groups continue to actively monitor any emerging evidence. And at the meeting in March 2014, as at the meeting in 2012 in January, February, the group agreed that the epidemiological data did not warrant a change to the medical eligibility criteria guideline. However, given the importance of this issue, women at high risk of HIV should be informed that progestogen-only injectables may or may not increase the risk of HIV acquisition. Women and couples at high risk of HIV acquisition considering progestogen-only injectables should also be informed about and have access to HIV preventive measures, including male and female condoms. This statement here is available within the technical statement that was issued in Melbourne and will be a part of the medical eligibility criteria final document that will be issued later this year. To move along to the recommendations for women living with HIV, these recommendations were informed by 2 systematic reviews, one that examined whether hormonal contraceptive methods accelerate HIV disease progression among women living with the infection, and another responded to the question of whether hormonal contraceptive methods increase the risk of female-to-male sexual transmission of HIV. The systematic review underpinning these recommendations will be published as well in the peer-reviewed literature. A review was published in 2013, and the update will be published very soon, we hope. But we want to make sure the synthesis is available to all of you in an open access format. But just to review the recommendations that were issued, I want to first start out by noting that during the revision of these recommendations, it became apparent that the terminology that is currently in the fourth edition of the MEC for HIV-related conditions it was outdated and inconsistent with both current clinical practice and other WHO documents. So as a result, we have replaced the previously used terms HIV infected and AIDS to be now reflect asymptomatic or mild HIV clinical disease, for example, WHO stage 1 or 2, and replace the AIDS terminology with severe or advanced HIV clinical disease corresponding to WHO stage 3 or 4. Just to briefly summarize, based upon the review of the evidence, WHO continues to recommend that there are no restrictions on the use of all hormonal methods of contraception with the exception of levonorgestrel-releasing intrauterine devices, where women, a 2, reflects that women can generally use the method if they have asymptomatic or mild HIV clinical disease. However, for women with severe or advanced HIV clinical disease, they should generally not initiate the use of this method until their illness has improved to asymptomatic or mild HIV clinical disease. However, in the column to the extreme right, you'll note that there is a 2, which means that if the woman develops severe advanced disease while she's actually using this method, she can continue to use the device, but she should be closely monitored for pelvic infection. Also, it bears noting, you can see the subscript in the table, and that corresponds to the indication that for all of these methods, with the exception of the intrauterine devices, with the copper bearing, which don't feature on this slide right here, it bears noting that because there may be drug interactions between hormonal methods and antiretroviral therapy, providers and policymakers should refer to the sexual and drug interactions, which I will now show if the slide advances. Okay. So lastly, in this statement, we provided recommendations for women who are living with HIV and using antiretroviral therapy. And what is new in this table is in the past, we provided broad recommendations for the class of antiretroviral drugs. However, based on the available evidence, we have now separated. We've still continued to provide recommendations for broad classes of antiretrovirals. However, now we also offer within for separate drugs because the recommendations do vary depending upon which antiretroviral drug the woman is using. So briefly, for NRTIs, there are no restrictions on the use of combined methods and progestogen-only methods with the exception of the levonorgestrel-releasing IUD, in which case the initiation is a 2/3. And what that means is that for women who want to initiate the levonorgestrel IUD, they are considered a category 2. If they have mild or asymptomatic clinical disease, whereas initiating for women with severe or advanced disease, they're considered a category 3. You'll note that for NNRTIs, for women using a taking a Favrans or nevirapine, they can generally use the methods, all the methods in the table, with the exception of initiating the levonorgestrel IUD if they have severe disease. For women using atravine or rivalparin, there are no restrictions. And then you'll note for protease inhibitors, if a woman's taking protease inhibitors, for with the exception of DMPA, the methods can be generally used. For women using the injectable method, there are no restrictions. And again, you see the levonorgestrel IUD recommendations being 2/3 for initiation, depending upon the severity of their disease. And if they are continuing to use the method, they can generally use it. And lastly, there are no restrictions on integrase inhibitors. And you'll note that in particular for efavirenz and nevirapine, the group wanted to highlight that for these medications, they have the potential to either decrease or increase level of steroid hormones in women using hormonal contraceptions. And some pharmacokinetic data has been published showing that the use of these methods may be reduced for women that are using these, taking these antiretrovirals. So lastly, I just want to, in conclusion, for women at high risk of HIV or living with HIV, WHO continues to recommend no restrictions for women using combined hormonal contraceptives or progesterone-only contraceptives. Women at high risk, women and couples at high risk of HIV infection and who use progesterone-only contraception should be informed about and have access to HIV prevention measures, including male and female condoms. And that levonorgestrel for these women, levonorgestrel IUDs can generally be used, with the note that they should be avoided if the woman has advanced or severe disease. Also, for women taking ART, WHO continues to recommend that they are generally eligible to use hormonal contraception, but there should be special consideration if the woman is taking efavirenz or nevirapine or some protease inhibitors. And most importantly, the group advised WHO to continue to promote consistent and correct use of condoms, male or female, because they're critical to protect against sexually transmitted infections and HIV, and also to prevent transmission of HIV. And just in conclusion, we have an active mechanism to continually review the evidence that our recommendations are to provide the foundation for our recommendations, and we do. Given the open question on this topic, we continue to strongly recommend further research to identify definitive answers and address the concerns about biological vulnerability to this infection and understand possible drug interactions. And I just want to note that the website where these recommendations are available is listed at the bottom of this slide. Thank you.
Great. Mary Lynn, thank you so much, and to Charlie and Kristen again, thank you all. And I realize there is a lot there in the three presentations, and I realize that some are going to jump off with the being at the top of the hour, but happily we are going to continue. We have lots of people still on the line, and questions have come in. As you will see in this slide, in addition to the virtual ways to deliver messages via the chat function or email, you can unmute at *7, and then we would ask that you hit *6 to remute your line. Let me start with one specific question to you, Kristen, that had come up, and then there are a couple of general ones, and then perhaps we'll open up the line. The one in one of the slides early on in comparing different meds, you've shown that sexual behavior risk was less with the implant than injectable, and someone on the line asked, why might that be, and if you have some hypothesis there?
Oh, that is a great question. And, you know, we found those findings very, very interesting. So, you know, for example, I might hypothesize that association could be explained by, you know, various demographic measures. So, for example, you might hypothesize that women using implants are older and more educated, and then that might lead to, you know, less unprotected sex. But what we want to do and we're working on right now is looking at what are the predictors of unprotected sex by method type in multivariate models. So I would say thank you for those results. We're also very interested to know.
Great. And actually, kind of a slightly different but related question also, Kristen, for you, but also I'd be happy for either Charlie across the meta-analysis or Mary Lynn to comment. Someone you focused, obviously, Kristen, and given the incredible track record that the whole Rwanda-Zambia team has focusing on couples counseling and working with serodiscordant couples in this analysis, does that bias the results and how does it, how might one consider the application to other demographic and social realities and relationships? And maybe I'll let you answer, and then, Charlie, if you had thoughts across the whole meta-analysis as well.
Oh, sure. I think that's also a really wonderful question. It's something that, you know, you want to think about in terms of the generalizability of your results. And I would say that in this case, no, that in fact, since the majority of adults in most sub-Saharan African countries, with the, you know, sort of notable exceptions of South Africa and Swaziland and perhaps a few other countries, but in most countries, the majority of adults are in heterosexual, stable partnerships. And so we feel that our findings are generalizable and representative, in fact, of this very large, in fact, the largest group of adults in Zambia.
Great, thanks. And Charlie, you know, you also did obviously so many different studies, some presumably with couples, some were presumably women who were not in stable relationships. Do you have a sense of that plays out across the 18 studies?
Well, in these 18 studies, there was one study among discordant couples and 17 that were not. You know, I'm not sure, you know, in some of the studies that I know really well, like our HCHIV study, we noticed, particularly the people in Uganda noticed that a lot of the infections came right after people switched partnerships. So I do think that there's a risk to having new partners or concurrent partners, and so that might be different than the, you know, the stable long-term relationships that most discordant couple cohorts include. So, you know, there are a lot of infections that happen in long-term relationships, but there are some that happen very early in those relationships too. You know, all the infections that you get from somebody with an acute infection generally are not in those long-term stable partnerships. So, You know, it's an important part of the population, the long-term serodiscordant couples, but I think there are, you know, there's other very large groups of women at risk as well.
Great, thank you. Mary Lynn, any comments on that? Well, let me then ask another question that had come in. That is both a simple question, but probably a very complicated answer. And it comes from someone who has worked on a number of clinical trials in South Africa, both with women in trials, but also in communities generally. And her question is pretty straightforward. What are the, based on all that you three have described, the results of Zambia, the meta-analysis, and WHO's review, she's asking, what are the key messages that should be given to either trial participants in a clinical trial or to women in general clinical practice? I mean, what's the bottom line message that you would want to be providing? And maybe I'll ask each of you to address that.
You know, I can jump in. I think that we need to tell women that, you know, I think for combined oral contraceptives, even though the data is no better than for depo, and I think that the consistency of the data really does suggest that there's not an important increased risk there. So I think that's one message that can be given. For Net N, it's I think somewhat unclear, but for Depo, it's also unclear. And I think you have to tell women that, you know, there have been good studies that suggest that women who use DMPA are at increased risk of HIV. There have been other good studies that do not suggest that. Because of the uncertainty of the data, you know, you need to be especially attuned to using, you know, HIV preventative measures, condoms, be careful about partner switching, et cetera. So I think they need to be told that message, because that's sort of the, it's not a terribly clear message, but it's the most, I think it's the most accurate message that we can give.
Hi, this is Mary Lynn. Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead, Mary Lynn.
Oh, okay. Sorry, I continue to push the wrong buttons. I'm sorry about that. I would,
no
problem. At least from our perspective, I would underscore what Charlie just mentioned. From our perspective, methods of contraception, there's only one right now that is both a contraceptive method and also a method that provides protection from sexually transmitted infections, including HIV. So main message would be to promote dual protection if there's a risk of infection, because these methods provide protection against pregnancy, but not against HIV and STIs. So that's women need to be informed, couples need to be informed about contraception and then also about infection risk, if there is an infection risk. But the message right now is that currently that condoms are the only method available right now that where we know there is protection against STIs and HIV.
Yeah, and I'll just second that. I completely agree with what Mary Lynn has just described, in that, you know, we need to continue the messaging of emphasizing dual method use for all women, all high-risk women, regardless of their method choice. And from our point of view, that we should also be testing the male partners of women to establish their HIV risk and to allow and enable appropriate counseling based on the couple sero status.
There's thank you, Free, for those responses. A question, actually, I think primarily for you, Mary Lynn, in terms of that, part of this updated recommendation that you described for women at high risk was that women should be informed of that. Progesterone-only injectables may or may not increase risk, as you described on the slide, and you reiterated that and makes tremendous sense. The question is, how might that message be delivered, and is there, how might it be operationalized? And not so much that's the recommendation from WHO, but do you have your guidance from WHO to implementing organizations for kink and reproductive health service delivery, or plans both to support how that gets operationalized, and also a way to monitor how women may respond to that information that's not been widely delivered historically in terms of what choices they might make.
As far as so if I understand, there are a couple of questions about the communication, the messaging for providers, and then the monitoring as well. Right now, our department is embarking on, I think actually the organization in general, way to better communicate what it recommends for organizations as far as, and countries as far as their normative standards. And we are in the throes of coming up with that strategy, and we hope to have something available when we issue the full guidance next year. But I understand that partners, particular USAID partners, PEPFAR-funded partners, and also UNFPA, others have actually developed messages from the guidance. And as far as monitoring, we don't have currently a mechanism to monitor, although we are in the throes of monitoring for developing a strategy to monitor how well all of our recommendations and the guidance are adopted. But for this particular question, we have not focused on that because our guidance actually is broader than that.
Great. Thanks, Mary Lynn. I'm delighted that so many people are still on the line after the hour, so thank you all. A number of additional questions have come in, but I think what I'll do is open the line in just one second. I do want to ask one question because I just can't resist that just came in from a friend and colleague. In the midst of this, the recommendations talk a great deal about putting male and female condoms, and someone's asked, should we be specifically investing more in female condom supplies for women currently using injectable contraception who can't insist on male condom use? So moving beyond a recommendation, to make sure that male and female condoms are promoted, but to actually fund and invest in that. Any comments, either Mary Lynn or anyone else?
Well, I understand, in fact, UNFPA has a big program directed at female condoms. So I think they would be better poised to talk about the resources. But in anything that we do, we actually promote that there should be a wide array of methods, including female condoms. So we would be very much in favor that it's a human right for women and couples to have a wide array of methods. And indeed, actually, it is a good point, well taken, that to have a method that the woman can control herself if it's difficult to negotiate with her partner. Indeed, that's it's a very sensible approach, and really UNFPA is the one leading that and funding programs for that. So that's definitely a very good idea.
Great. And I think both the last two questions and your responses, Mary Lynn, highlight both the importance of WHO recommendations but also the challenges of making them so in practice. A number of additional questions have come in, but let me pause and see if any of those questioners want to ask it live on the line or anyone else. If you want to hit *7 to unmute your line, I would ask that you introduce yourself, ask, and then remute yourself with *6. Any questions on the line? All right. Well, I'm happy to ask a few others. Charlie, there was a question specifically for you. You said something about non-condom use not having, in the meta-analysis, not having been related to increased HIV, and that seemed odd. And do you know the numbers about condom use across the meta-analysis?
Yeah, I mean, what we were saying there was we were reporting the relationships between hormonal contraception and HIV risk when women did not report condom use. So there were some women that, while their times were during their times in study, never said that they never used condoms throughout their whole time. So that would include all of those women. Plus, there were women who, at the beginning of their times in the study, let's say during the first year, did not report using condoms and then started using condoms. So to include their person time up to the point where they started using condoms. So I think look that up. You're interested in, what the proportion of women were that reported not using condoms, like the proportion of the women time? Is that essentially?
I believe so, yes.
Okay, let me just look that up and I can get back.
No. And while we look at that, another great question for you, Kristen, that it appeared that you showed there was based on the statistical significance, there was not a relationship, but that there was a low-level risk, perhaps, with a confidence interval that did go below one, that was not incompatible with prior studies. And a question about what was the power of the study, and also if you could comment on the retention of participants throughout the course of this analysis.
Sure. Those are great questions as well. In terms of the power, we certainly had limited power, especially when looking at the effect of the contraceptive implant on HIV acquisition. So this, of course, does leave the open the possibility for a type 2 error, especially for the association between HIV acquisition and implant. Regarding that association, we sort of felt that if we didn't see an association with the MPA, that we didn't really expect to see it with the implant. But then, there is certainly this argument that when you have limited power, you should be really looking at, say, the magnitude and the direction of the measure of association. And so I've given a lot of thought to that. And my answer would basically be that even if, for the sake of argument, that these measures had been significant, so, if we had a larger sample size, et cetera, that would still not change the recommendations that I gave at the end of the talk, focused on dual method use promotion, LARC promotion, and method mix promotion, and promotion of integrated couples testing and family planning. And I say this in part based on, the modeling studies that have been done and the findings from Butler and Tim Hallett that have come out indicating that, in Zambia and in many other countries, even if this risk-weight ratio were significant, it wouldn't indicate that policies need to be changed. And, policies that halted injectable use, for example, at this level of risk could, in fact, result in more maternal deaths. Oh, and then I think in terms of retention, this is a 17-year cohort. It's the data I'm presenting, so of course it's a very issue to think about loss of follow-up. And so we've actually published, we have a few articles that are specifically looking at retention in our cohorts and predictors of enrollment, predictors of attrition. And if you're just to pull out the male positive, female negative couples, we know that the factors that are predictive of attrition include, living far from the clinic, the younger age of the couple, and women having first intercourse at less than 17 years of age. So we would like to, make the caveat that perhaps our findings are more generalizable to relatively older contraceptive experienced couples.
Great, thanks. That's really helpful, Kristen. And I want to just a quick logistics point. A number of people have asked. The recording and presentations will be available on the ABAC website at abac.org/research-reality later today. It takes a little while to get the recordings and everything done, so stay tuned. It will be there. I realize we are over time, but grateful for many who stayed. I do want to return to one issue that Charlie, you highlighted in one of your concluding remarks, and Mary Lynn, you did as well. In your final slide, you talk about, Mary Lynn, the strong support from WHO for further research. And I guess actually for all three of you, I'd love to hear what specific further research you think is prioritized. Charlie, in your closing comment, you did talk about the need for a well-conducted randomized controlled trial to explore and provide more definitive evidence, an issue that has been the subject of several ABAC webinars and lots of conversations, both people quite passionately in favor of a trial and many concerned about the trial for a number of reasons. But I wonder if maybe we could focus first, Charlie and Mary Lynn, about where things currently with the proposed randomized controlled trial. I'd like to hear from all three of you also about, more broadly, what is the further research agenda and what are the priorities?
Well,
Mitchell, am I unmuted or am I,
you are
on the phone? Oh, okay, great. Sorry to jump in. This is Mary Lynn. At least from my perspective, as being responsible for these guidelines, there are still quite, there's more data. Thankfully, there's more data that we were able to review this earlier this year on ARV drug interactions for women taking hormonal contraception, but there's still quite a few questions. So I know there's been a lot of attention to other areas on this topic, but I think a tremendous question, particularly in southern Africa, the countries there, we are being asked a lot of questions about the effectiveness of efavirenz and nevirapine. And so I believe that's a priority to solidify and to collect better data on that specific issue. As far as the, I'll let Charlie speak more about the trial, because WHO is involved as the Secretariat for the Data Sector Monitoring Board, but I know Charlie is really one of the main PIs for this, I believe, and he can really speak to this topic.
Well, yeah, I can just quickly say that, you know, we have a 1.0 protocol for the ECHO study, which is evidence for contraceptive options and HIV outcomes, which is the protocol outlines a randomized clinical trial of women randomized to DMPA, to the levonorgestrel implant, or to the copper IUD. And we've selected 11 sites in four countries that we think are all well positioned to conduct the study. We've gone back and forth with our funders group several times because raising the sufficient amount of funds has been quite a daunting task. And we've had to redesign the study once or twice. So we're sort of waiting for their feedback on a revised study design, which is the one I just outlined, and a revised budget. And so we are hoping to hear from them in the next week or two. you know, I think it is important to continue to do some of the biological studies, for example, in specimens taken from women, et cetera, to try to understand, you know, the more specific immunological mechanisms, mechanisms between these various methods in the immune system. And there are a whole host of studies going on at this time to look at that. But I don't think that any of those by themselves will answer the question about whether, you know, for example, DMPA increases susceptibility to HIV infection. It can help to explain what I think that the trials find, but it will not answer that question in and of itself. So I think getting a trial up and going is really important to answering this question and being able to give more definitive both evidence and recommendations to women and to countries and programmers, et cetera. Just going back, somebody had asked about the condom use. About there were 12,500 women years where women reported using no condoms. So that was about a third of the study size, and there were 332 incident infections group. And basically, you know, we had found an overall hazard ratio of 1.5. That was a little bit higher in the no condom use group, 1.6. A little bit for net in as well, but still relatively similar. So,
great, thanks, Charlie. Christine, did you have any comments about that last issue on research going forward?
Yeah, I'd love to just make a few comments about that, and I know we're running short on time, but so I know there's been quite a bit of promotion and discussion of the strengths of the RCT on the ABAC website and in other places. And I think it's important for the sake of balance, just to kind of give pause to the arguments that people have raised against the RCT and perhaps the concerns that myself and others feel, you know, need to be addressed before an RCT moves forward. So I'll just outline a couple of those arguments here. And for me, they kind of go in three different categories. So there's some validity concerns, some ethical concerns, and you know, ideas about what will these results mean for policy. So, you know, there are some concerns with the validity of the data that can be produced. If, for example, if there are high rates of method switching that can make the data very difficult to analyze. And we know from our own work that method switching and stopping is quite common. There's also a concern that true randomization of confounders can actually potentially not be achieved. And this idea is that, you know, there's a lot of literature suggesting that women change their sexual behaviors differentially by the method they're using. And, of course, we cannot blind women to these methods. So those critical confounders, things like frequency of sex, condom usage, et cetera, potentially could not be randomized away. In terms of the ethics, I'm just, you know, I haven't read the protocol, but I'm interested to know if the partners of women enrolled in the trial will be tested. Finally, I'll just make this last point about the policy implications. You know, there are some concerns around, you know, if the magnitude of the result will you know, be able to direct or influence policy. So, you know, if we see an increased risk, what do we do with that information? Does the risk outweigh decreases in maternal and child mortality? You know, what do we do if we see an equivalency of the methods? So I just want to bring all of this up. Since this is such an expensive and long trial, I think that, you know, these are very important questions that we're all kind of thinking about and, you know, are very important to discuss in advance. And to basically try to elucidate every policy choice for every potential, you know, likely trial outcome to make sure that these resources are being spent in a way that, you know, we can be sure will maximize women's health.
Now, thanks, Christian. I don't know, Charlie, if you wanted to respond to any of that as someone who's been involved in the design.
Well, I can say that we have put together tables, as has been considered by our funders, et cetera, of what the different combinations of results could be and what some of the policy outcomes would be from each of those. So that is something that our various funders we have laid out and we've discussed with our funders in quite a bit of depth. And let me just say that this is not something that has come up, you know, recently. We've been really working on this for 2.5 years planning the study. So many of these issues have been discussed in quite a bit of depth. I do want to point out also that although it is true the randomization is likely to equalize a number of the characteristics at baseline, and it may not for during the follow-up period, but we will be trying to have some measures of exposure to semen among the different groups. And from some of the big studies, we have not seen differences, for example, in condom use among women using different highly effective contraceptive methods. Of course, you do when you have a group that you're comparing it to of women that are, many of them are not using contraception. Then the levels are quite different. But there are several studies that we've looked at, some of the really large studies, for example, the HIV study, and there are other studies as well that have shown long-term condom use being relatively quite similar between women using DMPA and using other hormonal methods. So we have some evidence that suggests that there would not be radically different, at least condom use, and I think some of the others between women using pretty much equally effective, highly effective contraceptive methods.
Thanks, Ryan. Thanks, Christian. I mean, this is a debate that will and I hope does continue because the questions are not academic. They're real for providers, policymakers, particularly for women at risk. So this is certainly not, and the call was not intended to address all those issues, but I'm delighted to have so many of them out on the table. I just do want to say, and I realize we are now well over time, but grateful I am to all three presenters and for so many people who stayed on the entire time. And nothing about either reproductive health or about HIV is ever easy, and combining the two makes it all the harder. And there is clearly so much that needs to happen in an era of uncertainty, whether that uncertainty is short-term until the ECHO trial or some other evidence clears up the uncertainty, whether the trial is eventually funded and doesn't answer the question, which is always a possibility with clinical trials, and uncertainty lasts longer, or if the trial doesn't get funded at all and we live in constant uncertainty, the need for all the things that Kristen, Charlie, and Mary Lynn described in expanding method mix of making real options available to women, not just in recommendations but in practice, both for contraception and for HIV prevention, is critical. And certainly none of this eliminates the essential need to continue HIV prevention research to make oral PrEP available to women at risk to hopefully finally understand whether tenofovir gel is an additional prevention option, and next year we'll have results there and of the dapivirine ring. So there are so many different agendas that all need resources, from the ECHO trial to new product development to delivering the technologies and options that are scientifically proven but not really available in women's lives and in clinics around the world. So the agenda is longer, not shorter. And we hope that this call is at least one additional piece to help everyone understand the landscape, even if we decide and agree to disagree on certain specific issues. As I said, this recording and presentations will be available on the website later today. There is an additional webinar next week, which will seemingly be a different topic, but is actually in many ways in my mind related, and that is a topic on the way forward in the AIDS response, particularly looking at targets. And I'm delighted that Chris Collins, now the Chief of Community Mobilization and Civil Society at UNAIDS in Geneva, will be on the call to present UNAIDS and their current thinking and targets, and hopefully you'll all join there, because I think many of the issues raised here need to be embedded into the targets going forward. So that is next week at the same time. And we clearly will have additional calls on this very topic as we all grapple with what to do next with or without the ECHO trial. But I want to really thank you, Kristen and Charlie and Mary, for terrific presentations and clarity in what you were presenting, and look forward to many more opportunities to discuss things.
Well, thank you so much.
Okay, thanks a lot, Mitchell.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye. Thank you.